Hello everyone and Namaskar. So today's podcast is a continuation of the reading of the book titled Anandamurti, the Jamalpur Years. And this is a reading of the 26th chapter titled Revolutionary Marriage. The people of Asia and America are touching each other's minds and have learned to accept each other sympathetically as their own. Europe, Africa, Australia, Mercury, Jupiter, the stars, the comets, the constellations. None of them is alien to the other. None is distant from another. Gradually everyone has begun to realize the vibration of the one integral mind. It is my firm conviction that the future of humanity is not dark. Every human being will attain that inextinguishable flame that is forever alight beyond the veil of the darkness of the present. As the new decade got underway, Baba began to rapidly expand and accelerate the activities of Anandamarga, paving the way for the transition to what he had termed the intellectual phase. His principal medium for this work was the rapidly growing number of acharyas. By 1960, he had created nearly 100 acharyas. Within the next few years, an even greater number would pass their acharya exam. More of Baba's time was now taken up with the training of these acharyas. He often held classes for them at the Jagrati. After one such class, in which he emphasized the importance of the work they were doing, he told them, "Mukti and moksha are in your folded fist. Anytime you wish, you can open your hand and get them. But for me, they are like a gold cot. I may take rest on it for a short while, but for endless time, I have to return to this soil and serve the creation. Now, all of you, tell me, what do you want? Do you want liberation and salvation? Or do you want to come with me, life after life, wherever I go, and serve the creation?" Every acharya present, many of them with tears in their eyes, replied that they wanted to come back with Baba to serve the creation. Despite the necessity of passing the acharya course, Baba's training methods extended far beyond his formal classes. Once, while returning from a DMC, Baba was traveling by train with a small group of acharyas. He took the opportunity to give them a class on certain aspects of the spiritual philosophy. During the conversation, Balendu, a quiet introverted man, complained to Baba that while he understood the philosophy, he still had trouble doing prachar. "I don't seem to be able to convince anyone to take initiation," he lamented. Baba nodded and agreed to give him some pointers. Moments later, the train pulled into a small station and a teenage boy entered the compartment. Baba called the boy over and asked him his name and where he was from. "Your house faces east, does it not?" Baba said. "And if I am not mistaken, right beside it there is a football field. And just behind the house, there is a small temple." The boy was understandably surprised. He nodded in agreement, and then listened with even greater astonishment as Baba described in great detail his house and his neighborhood. "But sir, how do you know my house and my neighborhood so well? I don't remember seeing you before. Did you used to live there?" Baba smiled but didn't answer. Instead, he began quoting the names of the boy's relatives back to his great-great-grandparents, telling him facts about them that the boy had never heard before. When he was finished, Baba said, "Look here, I have told you many useful things about your family that you should know. Will you do one thing for me? These fellows here are acharyas of Anandamarga. They teach meditation and yoga. Would you be willing to learn meditation and yogic practices from one of them? This will be for your welfare. It will help you in your studies also." The boy agreed with alacrity. Baba instructed Kshitij to note down his contact information and arrange for his initiation as soon as possible. After the boy got down at the next station, Baba turned to Balendu. "You see how it is done, Balendu." Everyone laughed. "I'm sorry, Baba," Balendu said, "but only God can do this. We are just human beings." Baba was laughing as well. "Okay then, have you ever attended a football match? If you watch carefully, you can easily see which people are really absorbed in the match. When someone makes a goal or a great play, they automatically react to it. They may shout, 'Goal!' or slap themselves on the thigh. Then you know that that person is really into the match. When you give a lecture, it's much the same. You should carefully scan the crowd to see who is really paying attention and responding to your talk. They'll nod their head when you make a point or give some such telltale sign. After the lecture, go up and talk to those people. You will find it easy to convince them to take initiation." Baba's acharya exams were also decidedly idiosyncratic, though the new candidates would sometimes be sent to his room for a formal oral exam. Baba would often give the exam at the tiger's grave, sometimes without any prior warning. 30 marks was a passing grade, but it was rare that anyone answered Baba's questions well enough to be able to pass the exam on the merit of their answers. If Baba was satisfied with their effort, he would give them grace marks to make up the difference. As might be expected, the exam was more a test of sincerity and surrender than of intellectual knowledge. It was not unheard of for a new acharya to pass his exam after receiving 1 mark for his answers and 29 grace marks. Mashin Bahadur, a member of the VMP, was the first Nepali acharya. He took his exam on the tiger's grave along with several others. Baba pointed to himself and told the candidates to imagine that he was a Muslim. Their task was to convince him to learn sadhana. Each took turns trying to convince Baba, but only Mashin Bahadur passed. A few months later, he recommended Giridhara Upadhyaya, a fellow Nepali officer, for acharya training, hoping to have another acharya in Nepal to help him with the work of Anandamarga. Giridhara was an enthusiastic practitioner of sadhana, as well as a Brahmin and a reputed scholar. When Mashin Bahadur proposed his name to Baba, Baba told him to give him training in Nepal and bring him to Jamalpur for his exam. By that time, Giridhara had already mastered the philosophy and was proud of his accomplishment. He was sure that whatever question Baba asked, he would be able to answer it. Again, the exam took place on the tiger's grave. Baba had only one question. "Giridhara, do you practice meditation regularly?" "Yes, Baba. At least 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour at night." "Then you must be able to remember your mantra." Yes, Baba. Then tell me your mantra. Try as he might, Giridhara was unable to answer. Baba turned to Mashin Bahadur and said, It seems his training is not yet complete. Train him for a few days more. Giridhara's ego was crushed. When they got back to the Jagriti, he explained to Mashin Bahadur that his mind had gone totally blank the moment Baba asked him to tell him his mantra. It is your ego, Mashin Bahadur said. Baba will not allow any expression of ego in his disciples. You have to learn to surrender, otherwise you'll never pass. Tell him mentally to do whatever he wants. Make me or break me, whatever be your wish. Giridhara understood. He spent the next couple of days surrendering mentally to Baba. Then Mashin Bahadur sent him for field walk again, alone this time. As Baba saw him approaching, he shouted out, Giridhara, go to the general secretary and collect your Acharya certificate. Bisheshwar's Acharya exam took place after he attended the first Prout training in Jamalpur in 1959. Pranay gave him his initial test after Baba had sent an order that he sit for the Acharya exam. Pranay asked him one question. Do you want to become an Acharya? Bisheshwar, a teacher from Araria, answered no. Pranay declared him passed and sent him on field walk for his final exam. When they reached the tiger's grave that night, Baba asked him several questions, none of which he could answer to Baba's satisfaction. The first question Baba asked was, If a Muslim girl wants to marry a Hindu boy, what should you do? I would give them permission, he answered. No, that is not the correct move. If they want to do a love marriage, then first, you should test the intensity of their love. You should tell the girl to ask the boy whether or not he would be willing to convert to Islam. If he shows his willingness, then it will prove he loves her. Tell Pranay that you failed the exam, but he can send you again tomorrow evening. You can repeat the exam then. When they reached the tiger's grave the next evening, Bisheshwar was thoroughly annoyed. He had already made up his mind to tell Baba that he didn't want to take the test, that it was too hard, that no one could pass such a test, and hence, he had decided not to become an Acharya. Before he had a chance to say anything, however, Baba took an Acharya certificate out of his pocket, wrote Bisheshwar's name on it, signed it, and handed it to him, without even mentioning the exam. Pratapaditya's exam took place at the tiger's grave in the summer of 1960. By then, a Prout section had been added to the regular exam. Since Pratapaditya had an MA in political science, he was sure he could pass this portion of the exam, at least without any difficulty. Baba's lone question was on an aspect of international politics he knew nothing about, and he was unable to answer. Keep studying, Baba told him. After a couple of days, he was sent back on field walk to take the Prout exam again. By this time, he had realized that it was not possible to pass Baba's exam unless Baba willed it so, that it was not a matter of knowledge, but of devotion. This time he did not even mention the exam. He was happy just to be sitting there with Baba. Someone else, however, mentioned it to Baba. Baba immediately asked him for his application. took out his flashlight and a pen, and wrote, "Past," across the top, without asking a single question. Bhavan's Acharya exam, which had taken place a few years earlier, had even less to do with philosophy. Gopin brought him to Baba's house for his exam, but instead, Baba took him to the field. They climbed up into the hills, and Baba took a seat on a large stone. "Go to the top of that hillock and jump down," Baba told him. "Don't worry, you won't get hurt." Bhavan did as Baba asked, shouting Baba's name as he jumped. He landed in a small patch of mud. Except for getting his clothes dirty, he was fine. As Baba was helping him to get unstuck, he said, "Your Acharya exam is now over. You passed." When Professor Indradev Gupta took his exam, he took the precaution of consulting with an authority on the subject before answering Baba's questions. Beloved Baba was giving darshan in Jamalpur. There were 10 to 12 of us. Suddenly Baba said that he was going to conduct an examination for all the trainees. At the very outset, Baba put a question to me in English. The question was as follows. "The human body is endowed with living cells. Because these cells have life, they possess life force as well as mind. Is the human mind then a conglomerate of all the minds of each of the cells?" Because the question was both difficult and in English, I didn't understand it. Since I didn't understand it, I remained silent. I kept gazing at Baba. "Why are you staring at me?" Baba said, half annoyed, half smiling. "It's your examination. Answer me. Think carefully and answer the question." Baba's facial expression used to have a fascinating, double-edged charm to it. He could simultaneously express both annoyance and sweetness. It was almost as if he could scold with one eye and enchant with the other. Then I thought, since I don't know the reply, let me ask him. I asked him mentally and immediately received an answer in my mind. I merely parroted what I heard, which was, "The human mind is an independent mind. Those living cells, which had been referred to earlier, also have independent minds that hold the possibility of becoming human minds. But they are in an undeveloped stage. However, the human mind is not a composite mind, but an independent entity." When Baba heard my reply, he said half annoyed, half sweetly, "No one will consult anyone before answering. Answers will be given independently." No one understood what he meant, since I hadn't asked any of them for the answer. But I understood. Baba was telling me to think it through myself. Then he asked his second question. "Does the unit mind, through the sensory organs, enjoy the original object or the shadow of the object? Or its shadow's shadow? Explain it logically." Since I didn't know the answer to this question either, I asked him internally again and received the answer. Then I repeated it orally. "The unit mind does not enjoy objects in their physical form. Through the sensory organs, the mind enjoys the tanmatras emanated by the physical world, composed of the five fundamental factors. So here the mind does not enjoy the original object, but rather its shadow, i.e. the tanmatras of the object. But this physical world itself is a shadow of the cosmic mind. So it can be said that the human mind does not enjoy the original object, the Supreme Consciousness, or its shadow, the physical world, but the shadow of the shadow, i.e., the tanmatras emanated by the physical world. The answer was correct. This time Baba was very upset. I said there should be no cheating. No one should consult with anyone else before giving his answer. Again, everyone but me was confused by what Baba said. Then Baba asked a third question. What is the difference between Purushottama and Nirguna Brahma from the point of view of philosophy? I didn't feel confident enough to reply. Since Baba had scolded me quite soundly the last time around, this time I remained silent. When Baba persisted, I plucked up my courage and said, "Baba, it seems that the person I consulted doesn't know the answer." Baba burst into laughter. Then he gave detailed answers to all three questions. After giving the answer to the third question, he quietly asked me, "Did the person you consulted know the correct reply?" I laughed. Everyone else was scratching his head. The general secretary could not contain himself anymore. "Baba, whom was he consulting before giving his replies?" Baba cleared up the confusion. He was answering all the questions by asking me. Then everyone broke into a chorus of laughter. Asin Kumar Patak took initiation from Acharya Kedarnath Sharma in Ranchi at the end of 1959, a few days before the first VSS camp that was held there at Birla Boring. He was 20 at the time, a student and an ardent devotee of Krishna, who had been fanatically practicing various yogic techniques from books for several years, adamant that he did not need or want a guru. While Baba was at Ranchi, Kedarnath brought Asim to a general darshan over the objections of Devi Chand Sharma, who insisted that the boy wait at least 6 months before seeing Baba, as per the rule. All Asim remembered from that first darshan was that it was so philosophical he couldn't understand a single sentence. Afterward, he was convinced that Baba was a clever pundit who was able to befool those gullible crying people with his high-sounding words. About half an hour later, Kedarnath told Asim that Baba wanted to see him. "Baba said that you came late," Kedarnath told him. "He said that you should have come long before." These words made Asim even more suspicious. He accompanied Kedarnath to Baba's room, where he found Baba eating his dinner. Before they went in, Kedarnath told him that he should do Sastang Pranam when he entered. But Asim was not about to do that. He gave Baba his namaskar, just as he would anyone else that he was meeting for the first time. Baba looked at him and asked, "What is the highest oxide of aluminum?" Asim was too surprised by the question to answer. "Aluminum tetroxide," Baba said. After a couple similar questions that Asim found equally irrelevant, he was led out of Baba's room, his frustration mounting. "Why did I come to these people?" he fumed as he was going home. "Why should I have to accept a guru? I don't want a guru." But as soon as he arrived home, he was overpowered by an inexplicable desire to see Baba again. It was a feeling of longing, greater than anything he had ever experienced. A sensation that he could only describe as having been forcefully separated from the person dearest to him in his life. By then it was after midnight. He knew it would be futile to head back at that hour. After a fitful sleep, he got up at 5, took a shower, and got on his bicycle to head back to the house where Baba was staying. It was 6 o'clock when he arrived. Devi Chand Sharma was standing outside the gate. "Come, Baba is waiting for you," he said as Asim rode up. "What do you mean? Baba is waiting for me. I didn't tell anybody I was coming." Devi Chand grabbed his hand and said in his normal gruff manner, "Come, you will understand everything." He led him into Baba's room, where Baba was waiting to conduct PC. Having informed Devi Chand earlier that Asim would be arriving at that time for personal contact. This time Asim did Sastang Pranam when he entered the room. As soon as he sat up, Baba began recounting details and incidents from his life that no one could have possibly known, one after the other, until Asim was convinced that Baba was able to read his mind. Baba told him why some of his practices he had learned from books were misguided. "Do you see now how much energy you have wasted by not having had proper guidance? Do you understand?" "Yes, Baba." "You know, if you write something on a piece of paper and put it under your pillow, but don't follow it in your life, then it has no value." "I haven't put anything underneath my pillow," he thought. "Perhaps Baba's power has reached its limit." Baba looked him in his eyes and said, "Don't you remember?" Suddenly a forgotten memory flashed in his mind. Some months earlier, he had written some inspirational advice from Aurobindo and the Buddha on a piece of paper and put it under his pillow, thinking to read it each morning when he woke up. But he had forgotten about it and never read it again. "Baba, how did you know that?" "Your mind tells me." Asim was not satisfied with the answer, since he himself had forgotten the incident. "Who are you?" he asked. Baba smiled. "I am not your guru. I am your Baba." Asim began to cry. Baba called him closer and touched his trikuti. He became lost in a blissful, effulgent light and entered into a state of trance. When he came out of his trance, Baba asked him to hold his feet and take an oath. The oath was in English, a language Asim didn't understand at the time. Asim repeated it and then asked Baba what it meant. Baba smiled and translated it into Hindi for him. Then he added, "You came very late. You should have come earlier." After his PC, Asim found himself torn between his devotion to Krishna and his love for Baba. When Baba returned to Ranchi in April, Asim heard that he would be given DMC in Saharsa in the middle of May to celebrate Ananda Purnima. He had no idea what DMC was, much less Ananda Purnima, but he was seized by a powerful desire to attend. When he told Baba of his desire, thinking that Baba might ask one of the older disciples to help him, Baba said, "Develop your willpower." After Baba left for Jamalpur, a sense of determination flared in Asim's mind. He started selling the few possessions he owned, a few books and some clothes, adamant that he would find a way to raise the money for the train ticket. But when Kshitij learned of what he was doing, he told him to stop. He would take him to Saharsa with him, Thus, on May 14, Asim found himself traveling in the same first-class compartment as Baba. While Baba was talking with the other devotees in the compartment, Asim decided to test him. He had seen that Baba could look within his mind. But was it really true, what the devotees said, that Baba recited within every mind, all the time? How could this be possible? If Baba really knows everything of everyone, all the time, he thought, he will look at me just now. At that moment, Baba turned and looked at him, and then returned to his conversation. Maybe it was a coincidence, Asim thought. Maybe he was thinking about me while he was talking to the other Margis. I'll let some time go by and try again. 15 or 20 minutes passed. Again, he said to himself, if he is really within everyone's mind all the time, then he will look at me just now. Again, Baba looked at him and smiled, and then turned to his conversation. Still, Asim was not 100% convinced. Maybe he was still paying attention to me somehow, he thought. But he can't possibly know what is going on inside my mind when his attention is occupied elsewhere. Shortly afterward, the train pulled into the next station, and a group of devotees entered and started talking with Baba. They brought him food and flowers and offered their pranams. Ah, Asim thought, now is the perfect opportunity. While Baba is busy with these margis, if he knows everything of this world all the time, he will look at me just now. Baba looked at him and said, my child, why are you thinking in this way? Again, Baba turned his attention back to the margis. Asim was left to choke down his embarrassment. Later in the trip, Asim had a chance to be alone with Baba in the compartment. Baba was reclining on his berth when he asked Asim to tell him 3 things he was proud of. Baba, the first thing I'm proud of is my singing voice. The second is that I'm handsome. And the third is that I'm a good devotee. You know, when I was a child, I used to study music with a teacher. He taught me some Rabindra Sangeeta. Do you want to hear? Yes, Baba. Please sing. Baba sang 3 songs. Kon Alote Praner Pradeep Jaliya. Sada Kaba Premi Kaba Pagologo, and Tumi Kahar Sandane. Asim was enthralled. It seemed as if he had never heard such a sweet voice in his life. Now you sing the same 3 songs, Baba said, and I will listen. Asim sang the first song, but after listening to Baba, his own voice sounded to him like a donkey's brain in the wake of a cuckoo song. He was so embarrassed that when Baba asked him to sing the 2nd song, he requested Baba to sing instead. No, Baba replied. It is a little difficult to sing while lying down. I want to take rest for a while. Some minutes later, the train pulled into the next station, and Chandranath's son, Amarnath, entered Baba's compartment along with several other margis. They all sat on the floor and started chatting merrily with Baba. Amarnath was 16 at the time and extremely handsome. When Asim looked at Amarnath sitting in front of Baba, he felt ugly by comparison. At the next station, Devi Chand Sharma entered Baba's compartment. Devi Chand, Baba said, tell me what you are proud of. Baba, I am only proud of 1 thing. I am your son. When Asim heard this, he felt a sinking feeling. What kind of devotee am I by comparison, he thought. Only then did he suspect that Baba had been playing a game with him in order to deflate his ego. When the train pulled into Saharsa, Asim was surprised to see that nearly 1,000 Margis had gathered for DMC. He had no idea that Ananda Marga was anything more than the guru and a handful of devotees. Baba was taken to the house of Bal Mukunda Rastogi, where a room had been prepared for him to stay during the program. It was breakfast time, but when Baba was brought his breakfast, he refused to eat it. The Margis became worried that they had committed some mistake. Cautiously, they asked Baba if they had done anything wrong. "No," he told them, "you haven't done anything wrong, but someone else has." Baba told them to call a certain Margi to his room. They went out to the compound where the Margis had gathered to attend Baba's darshan and made an announcement by loudspeaker, but no one came forward. Knowing that Baba would not eat until they found him, they conducted a search. And finally, they found a young man sleeping behind the stage. They brought him to Baba along with his acharya. As soon as he was presented to Baba, Baba asked him how he had came. "By train, Baba." "I know, but how did you come?" "By train. That is not what I am asking. Did you purchase a ticket?" "Yes, Baba." "And where did you get the money for this ticket?" This time the young man did not answer, but his fear was visible on his face. "Nothing to say, huh? Then I will tell the story of how you got this money." Baba looked at the Margis and pointed to the young man. "This boy has committed a crime. He stole that money from the pocket of a carpenter. 62 rupees. It was the man's monthly earnings. He was on his way to purchase provisions for his family. After he noticed that the money was gone, he became so distraught. He began saying that there is no God in this universe, no divine justice, that he was going to commit suicide because he was a poor man and could not survive without that money. Now I am responsible, since it is my devotee who stole his money." Baba called the young man's acharya and started scolding him for initiating the boy without having properly evaluated his conduct. Then he told the young man to touch the feet of everyone present and leave. When he was going out the door, Baba called him back. "I want you to return that money to the person he stole it from." The young man was crying now. "But Baba, how can I do that? I don't know who he is or where he lives." "You will not get off so easily. Ask someone here to run to the post office and bring back a money order form." A few minutes later, one Margi returned with the form. Baba took out his pen and wrote the name and address of the carpenter on it. He handed it to the boy. "Now go to the post office with your acharya and send the money. Write on the back of the money order that you have stolen this money from him and now you are returning it." Baba told the young man's acharya to make sure that he followed his instructions. When they had gone, he told the Margis, "Actually, he is a sincere devotee. When I conducted his PC, I took an oath from him not to pick any more pockets. Up until a few days ago, he had kept his oath. But when he heard that Baba was coming here, he decided to pick one last pocket so that he can have my darshan. So you see, it is my responsibility." On the night of the DMC, Asim was seated near the front. During the Guru Puja that followed Baba's discourse, he suddenly saw Baba disappear from the platform. In his place, he saw the figure of Krishna, surrounded by the bright blue effulgence. Within moments, Asim lost consciousness of his surroundings. He started making a soft choking sound. Several minutes passed. When he opened his eyes again, he saw Baba standing in front of him, on his way out of the compound. "Buyecho?" Baba asked him in Bengali. "Understood?" Asim reached out and grabbed Baba. "Discipline, discipline," Baba ordered. Asim let go. But as soon as Baba left, he started crying and remained in that condition for the next 7 or 8 days. By 1960, Baba had become an auditor in the accounts department with a reputation for strictness and thoroughness that was unmatched in the workplace. Even high-ranking officers used to become apprehensive when they heard that P.R. Sarkar was coming to inspect their office. And it was commonly whispered that if there were any irregularity in their accounts, P.R. Sarkar would be sure to find it. His subordinates recalled that when they accompanied him on inspection, he would regularly direct them to the exact page of the exact ledger that contained bookkeeping errors, something they were used to from the accounts office, where he would often call out across the room while they were working to alert them to an incorrect entry they had just made. Nor was it a secret that Baba vocally condemned some of the senior officers for the way they treated the people who worked for them. In early summer, Baba went to inspect the books of Sarvananda, one of the supervisory officers. When Baba found evidence of corruption and misappropriation of funds, Sarvananda tried to convince him to hush it up. Baba not only made the matter public, he scolded him mercilessly in front of his subordinates. Things soon became uncomfortable for Sarvananda, that within a matter of weeks, he resigned from his job. But not before filing a report that eventually led to Baba being transferred. Part of the charges levied against him was that he was allegedly converting Muslims to Hinduism. Shortly after Sarvananda's departure, notice arrived of Baba's transfer to Asansol, some 220 kilometers from Calcutta. A furor broke out among the local Margis, who were aghast at the thought of losing Baba to another city, and worried about how they would be able to administer the organization without Baba's immediate physical guidance. Pranay called the meeting of all Acharyas and senior Margis. They took a collective decision to ask Baba to resign from his service. Pledges were taken to provide Baba with the money he would need to maintain his family. Then they took the proposal to Baba in the form of a written letter. Baba read the letter and wrote, "Rejected," at the top. "It is a good proposal," he said, "but it is not yet time for me to resign from my service. Nor is there any reason to worry about my transfer. Let tomorrow take care of tomorrow. For now, I will go on leave. Let us see what happens." Baba requested 1 month's leave for the stated purpose of putting his personal affairs in order. The day before he went on leave, Nilen Bose approached him during the lunch break to commiserate. "Now that you are leaving Jamalpur, what are we going to do without you?" he said. "Every day we listen to your stories and your advice. When will we ever get such a chance again? Don't worry, Baba said. I will not be transferred. But your transfer letter has come. I assure you, after my leave is over, I will be sitting at this same desk, doing the same work. Baba did not, however, mention this to the Margis, nor did he make any plans or preparations, either personal or organizational. Instead, he went on tour to a number of different cities where Ananda Marga was active. Whenever Pranay or other Margis brought up his transfer, he told them that there was no need to be concerned. Time would take care of it. At the end of June, while Baba was on leave, he developed a boil on his leg. Instead of taking rest, as Pranay insisted, he went to Muzaffarpur as scheduled and stayed there for 8 days in the house of Acharya Sakaldev. The word spread quickly that Baba had come, and Sakaldev's house was soon turned into an ashram, with devotees constantly coming and going to see Baba and attend the morning and evening general darshan. One day, Baba was sitting in his room with Acharya Gangasharan and his family. In the course of the conversation, Gangasharan asked his niece, Indu, in a playful way, when she was going to get married. When she didn't reply, Baba answered for her. "Don't worry," he said. "The groom will appear on this very doorstep within a few days." Then Baba explained his concept of revolutionary marriage. The easiest and best way to break down the barriers that separate different races and different cultures is through intercaste and intercultural marriage. Suppose a girl and a boy from different castes marry. It will help to dissolve their own caste feeling, and their children will have no caste. Suppose a boy of this land marries a girl from England. He would never like to see England ruined and vice versa. Nor will their children have anti-English or anti-Indian feelings. It is the easiest way to break down these barriers. A couple days later, Sujit was massaging Baba when Baba sent him home on pretext that he wanted to do sadhana. Shortly after he left, Gangasharan arrived with his family and a number of other Margis, including Nagina and Shashi Ranjan. While Baba was conversing with them, he announced that he wanted a revolutionary marriage to be solemnized within the next 24 hours. Indu, if she agreed, would be the bride. Sujit would be the groom. Baba sent someone to bring Sujit, who was surprised that Baba would call him back so quickly. When Sujit entered the room and did pranam, Baba told him, "Sujit, if you agree and the girl agrees, then I want you to marry Indu." Baba called Indu into the room and repeated what he had told Sujit. The marriage was fixed for the following evening. The sudden decision was a shock to both the bride and the groom, but they acceded to the wish of their guru. Despite the fact that they not only came from different castes, but lived in Bihar, the most caste-conscious region of India. In fact, it would be many years before either Sujit's parents or the other non-Margi members of his family would openly accept their marriage or offer any kind of support to the young couple. The next morning in General Darshan, July 8, Gangasharan folded his hands in namaskar and invited everyone to the wedding. Then, getting slightly carried away, he invited all the subtler and subtlest entities of the universe, as well as all disciples of Baba on this planet or any other. The marriage was celebrated that evening with a traditional wedding procession. Baba accompanied the groom's party halfway to Ganga Sharan's house, where the bridal party was waiting to receive them. Then he asked his driver to take him to Ganga Sharan's so he can welcome the groom's party as a member of the bridal party. On his arrival there, he politely requested everyone not to insult him, since he was coming as a member of the bride's party. It being the custom in Bihar for the bride's party to welcome guests from the groom's side with colorful abusive epithets. The ceremony took place on the roof of Ganga Sharan's house, a spacious, flat surface that was able to accommodate the more than 300 margis and neighbors who attended. Many neighbors, unable to attend for lack of space, climbed into the nearby trees to watch. Devotional songs followed, and Indu quickly became abnormal, carried away by her devotional fervor. Baba scolded her and warned her that if she didn't remain normal for her wedding, he wouldn't stay. Then he joked that it was normal for Indu to become abnormal. During the reception afterward, it was her new husband's turn to become abnormal during the devotional singing. That night, while Ganga Sharan was sleeping on the veranda, he had a dream that many saints and sages with white beards and beads entered the compound, paid their respects to the new couple, and went away. The next morning, when Baba was getting ready to leave for Jamalpur, Ganga Sharan asked him about his dream. "It was due to your invitation," Baba said. "Do you think that human beings were the only beings to attend?" After the wedding, Indu and Sujit went to Jamalpur for what amounted to their honeymoon. They went on field walk with Baba on their first night there. The next day, a telegram arrived from Pranay in Bolpur with the message that he needed an English-speaking acharya right away to deliver a lecture at Shantiniketan University. Baba asked Sujit to go. He selected a topic and gave him some suggestions on how to organize his talk. Then he called Sujit and Indu into his room to bless their marriage. That night, Sujit left for Shantiniketan, and the honeymoon was over. Neither one complained. For both of them, Baba's work came first, and this would continue to be the theme of their lives. The same week, a letter arrived from Baba's sister in Chinchura, informing him that his son, Gautam, had been born on the 9th in Bandel at Uma Sarkar's parents' house, where she had gone for the last stage of her pregnancy and the birth of her first child, in keeping with a centuries-old Indian tradition. Baba noted down the date in his diary, but as usual, there was nothing in his demeanor to show that anything had changed. Even after Uma Devi returned to Jamalpur a few weeks later with the newborn child. After Indu and Sujit's marriage, revolutionary or inter-caste, intercultural marriages quickly became the norm in Anandamarga. Instead of looking for suitable partners within their caste, a rigid practice in traditional Hindu society, or within their religion, in the case of other religions, Margi family started making it known that any caste would be acceptable, except their own. the backlash from the non-Margi members of their families, as well as from neighbors and colleagues, was predictable and immediate. In a country and at a time where it was not unheard of for intercaste couples to be physically attacked or even killed for breaking taboo. It was the norm rather than the exception for such couples to be ostracized by their family and community, especially in smaller towns and rural areas where such marriages were considered unthinkable. Each couple had their stories to tell of the trials they had to face, but they accepted them willingly and pointed to them as a badge of honor in their struggle to spread their guru's teachings. Yours should be a pauseless struggle against corruption, hypocrisy, and animality, Baba had told them. And in January 1961, he gave them the message that would become the foremost creed of all Margis. As the organization began to grow rapidly and meet the mounting opposition that Baba had warned them to expect, fight for your ideology, be one with your ideology, live for your ideology, die for your ideology. Revolutionary marriage was simply another way to put their ideology into practice, one that would have far-reaching consequences, both for the couples that embraced it and for the society they lived in. With the rapid implementation of intercaste marriage and the strict prohibition against accepting dowry, already long since established in the Ananda Marga community, only one social evil regarding marriage remained to be dealt with: the prohibition against widow remarriage. For several thousand years, there had existed a strict ban against widow remarriage in Hindu society. When a woman's husband died, she was expected to remain in chaste enclosure for the rest of her life, either in self-imposed exile, in her husband's house, or in some cases, banished to widow's ashrams. For centuries, a woman who immolated herself on her husband's funeral pyre, a practice known as sati, was considered the most virtuous of women and promised liberation by the scriptures. In fact, the word sati means virtuous woman. Though the British had outlawed sati in the 19th century, the social taboos against widow marriage still remain firmly in place. With the publication of Charyacharya, Baba removed the taboo within the community of his disciples. He declared that any man who married a widow or a shelterless, fallen, or outcast woman would be considered Dharma Mitram, a friend of Dharma, and would be honored with that title within Ananda Marga. A few months after Sujit's marriage, Shambhunath Burma married a widow, the first example of such a marriage in Ananda Marga. He received Baba's outspoken praise and the title of Dharma Mitram. In November, Baba went to Motihari to give his blessings to the newly married couple. He held a special DMC for them and the local Margis in Nagina's quarters. Thereafter, widow remarriage became a common occurrence in Ananda Marga. After Sujit's marriage, Baba extended his leave by an additional month and continued touring various cities. During this time, he told the Margis that they should start making preparations for propagating the ideology outside India. Three Acharyas, Arstana, Sarangi, and Srivastava, took the initiative to form a committee and propose the name Foreign Prachar Committee to Baba. "You can use this name for the time being," Baba told him, "but at some point, it will have to be changed. No one is foreign to us." He quoted a Sanskrit saying, "Hara me pita, gauri mata, swadesha, bhuvantrayam." The Lord is my father, Prakriti is my mother, and the universe is my homeland. He went on to explain why Anandamarga would gain acceptance in other countries. First, because neither capitalism nor communism can fulfill the needs of human life, and hence have no future. Only a spiritually based economy can succeed. Second, because people outside of India are hungry for spirituality, and those with a scientific or rational background will easily adopt our ideology. Baba then gave a long discourse about the different cultures of the world, their languages, religions, social customs, history, geography, and flora and fauna. One Margi asked Baba, "We see you all the time in Jamalpur. When did you visit those countries to be able to know them so well?" Baba laughed and said, "In the government, you have a system of special messengers to convey and collect messages and information. I also have my own courier system that brings everything to me at Jamalpur." When his leave was about to finish, Baba returned to Jamalpur to a group of concerned Margis who were wondering what action they should take now that his transfer could be put off no longer. But the next day, a telegram arrived in the accounts department canceling the transfer. When an excited Pranay brought the telegram to Baba, he smiled and continued with what he was doing, as if it were of no more importance than a passing breeze. Thank you.